Eddie had bent to examine the walking box. Now he straightened up and stared at Roland. "That can't be." He sounded like a man trying to explain to a small child that there really isn't a boogeyman living in his closet, that there can't be because there isn't any such thing as the boogeyman, not really. Worlds don't grow, Roland. Don't they? When I was a boy, Eddie, there were maps. I remember one in particular. It was called the Greater Kingdoms of the Western Earth. It showed my land, which was called by the name Gilead. It showed the downland baronies, which were overrun by riot and civil war in the year after I won my guns, and the hills and the desert and the mountains and the Western Sea. It was a long distance from Gilead to the Western Sea, 1,000 miles or more, but it had taken me over 20 years to cross that distance. "That's impossible," Susanna said quickly, fearfully. "Even if you walked the whole distance, it couldn't take 20 years. "Well, you have to allow for stops to write postcards and drink beer," Eddie said, but they both ignored him. "I didn't walk, but rode most of the distance on horseback," Roland said. "I was slowed up, shall we say, every now and then, but for most of that time I was moving. Moving away from John Farson, who led the revolt which toppled the world I grew up in and who wanted my head on a pole in his courtyard. He had good reason to want that, I suppose, since I and my compatriots were responsible for the deaths of a great many of his followers. And because I stole something he held very dear." "What, Roland?" Eddie asked curiously. Roland shook his head. "That's a story for another day. Or maybe never. For now, think not of that, but of this. I've come many thousands of miles, because the world is growing."
"A thing like that just can't happen," Eddie reiterated, but he was badly shaken all the same. "There'd be earthquakes, floods, tidal waves. I don't know what all. Look," Roland said furiously. "Just look around you. What do you see? A world that is slowing down like a child's top, even as it speeds up and moves on in some other way none of us understand. Look at your kills, Eddie. Look at your kills for your father's sake."
He took 2 strides toward the stream, picked up the steel snake, examined it briefly, and tossed it to Eddie, who caught it with his left hand. The snake broke in 2 pieces as he did so.
"You see? It's exhausted. All the creatures we found here were exhausted. If we hadn't come, they would have died before long anyway, just as the bear would have died."
"The bear had some sort of disease," Susanna said. The gunslinger nodded.
"Parasites, which attack the natural parts of its body. But why did they never attack it before?"
Susanna did not reply. Eddie was examining the snake. Unlike the bear, it appeared to be a totally artificial construction, a thing of metal, circuits, and yards, or maybe miles, of gossamer-thin wire. Yet he could see flecks of rust, not just on the surface of the half-snake he still held, but in its guts as well. And there was a patch of wetness, where either oil had leaked out or water had seeped in. This moisture had rotted away some of the wires, and a greenish stuff that looked like moss had grown over several of the thumbnail-sized circuit boards. Eddie turned the snake over. A steel plate proclaimed it to be the work of North Central Positronics Limited. There was a serial number, but no name. "Probably too unimportant to name," he thought. "Just a sophisticated mechanical roto-rooter designed to give old Brer Bear an enema every once in a while, keep him regular, or something equally disgusting." He dropped the snake and wiped his hands on his pants. Roland had picked up the tractor gadget. He yanked at one of the treads. It came off easily, showering a cloud of rust down between his boots. He tossed it aside. "Everything in the world is either coming to rest or falling to pieces," he said flatly. "At the same time, the forces which interlock and give the world its coherence, in time and size as well as in space, are weakening. We knew that even as children, but we had no idea what the time of the end would be like. How could we? Yet now I am living in those times, and I don't believe they affect my world alone. They affect yours, Eddie and Susanna. They may affect a billion others. The beams are breaking down. I don't know if that's a cause or only another symptom, but I know it's true. Come, draw close. Listen.
As Eddie approached the metal box with its alternating diagonal slashes of yellow and black, a strong and unpleasant memory seized him. For the first time in years, he found himself thinking of a crumbling Victorian wreck in Dutch Hill, about a mile away from the neighborhood where he and Henry had grown up. This wreck, which was known as the Mansion to the neighborhood kids, occupied a plot of weedy, untended lawn on Reinhold Street. Eddie guessed that practically all the kids in the borough had heard spooky stories about the mansion. The house stood slumped beneath its steep roof, seeming to glare at passers-by from the deep shadows thrown by its eaves. The windows were gone, of course. Kids can throw rocks through windows without getting too close to a place. But it had not been spray-painted, and it had not become a make-out spot or a shooting gallery. Oddest of all was the simple fact of its continued existence. No one had set it on fire to collect the insurance or just to see it burn. The kids said it was haunted, of course, and as Eddie stood on the sidewalk with Henry one day, looking at it, they had made the pilgrimage specifically to see this object of fabulous rumor, although Henry had told their mother they were only going for Hoodsy Rockets at Dahlberg's with some of his friends, it had seemed that it really might be haunted. Hadn't he felt some strong and unfriendly force seeping from that old Victorian shadowy windows that seemed to look at him with the fixed stare of a dangerous lunatic? Hadn't he felt some subtle wind stirring the hairs on his arms and the back of his neck? Hadn't he had the clear intuition that if he stepped inside that place, the door would slam and lock behind him, and the walls would begin to close in, grinding the bones of dead mice to powder, wanting to crush his bones the same way? Haunting. Haunted. He felt that same old sense of mystery and danger now as he approached the metal box. Goose flesh began to ripple up his legs and down his arms. The hair on the back of his neck bushed out and became rough, overlapping hackles. He felt that same subtle wind blowing past him, although the leaves on the trees which ringed the clearing were perfectly still. Yet he walked toward the door anyway, for that was what it was, of course, another door, although this one was locked and always would be against the likes of him, not stopping until his ear was pressed against it. It was as if he had dropped a tab of really strong acid half an hour ago, and it was just beginning to come on heavy. Strange colors flowed across the darkness behind his eyeballs. He seemed to hear voices murmuring up to him from long hallways like stone throats, halls which were lit with guttering electric torches. Once these flambeaux of the modern age had thrown a bright glare across everything, but now they were only sullen cores of blue light. He sensed emptiness, desertion, desolation, death. The machinery rumbled on and on, but wasn't there a rough undertone to the sound, a kind of desperate thudding beneath the hum, like the arrhythmia of a diseased heart? A feeling that the machinery producing this sound, although far more sophisticated even than that within the bear had been, was somehow falling out of tune with itself? All is silent in the halls of the dead, Eddie heard himself whisper in a falling, fainting voice. All is forgotten in the stone halls of the dead. Behold the stairways which stand in darkness. Behold the rooms of ruin. These are the halls of the dead, where the spiders spin and the great circuits fall quiet one by one. Roland pulled him roughly back, and Eddie looked at him with dazed eyes. That's enough, Roland said.
Whatever they put in there isn't doing so well, is it?
Eddie heard himself ask. His trembling voice seemed to come from far away. He could still feel the power coming out of that box. It called to him. No, nothing in my world is doing so well these days.
If you boys are planning to camp here for the night, you'll have to do without the pleasure of my company, Susanna said.
Her face was a white blur in the ashy aftermath of twilight.
"I'm going over yonder. I don't like the way that thing makes me feel."
"We'll all camp over yonder," Roland said. "Let's go."
"What a good idea," Eddie said.
As they moved away from the box, the sound of the machinery began to dim. Eddie felt its hold on him weakening, although it still called to him, invited him to explore the half-lit hallways, the standing stairways, the rooms of ruin where the spiders spun and the control panels were going dark, one by one. In his dream that night, Eddie again went walking down 2nd Avenue toward Tom and Jerry's artistic deli on the corner of 2nd and 46th. He passed a record store, and the Rolling Stones boomed from the speakers. "I see a red door, and I want to paint it black. No colors anymore, I want them to turn black. I see the girls walk by dressed in their summer clothes. I have to turn my head until my darkness goes." He walked on, passing a store called Reflections of You between 49th and 48th. He saw himself in one of the mirrors hanging in the display window. He thought he looked better than he had in years, hair a little too long, but otherwise tanned and fit. The clothes, though, man, square bare shit all the way, blue blazer, white shirt, dark red tie, gray dress pants. He had never owned a yuppie from hell outfit like that in his life. Someone was shaking him. Eddie tried to burrow deeper into the dream. He didn't want to wake up now, not before he got to the deli and used his key to go through the door and into the field of roses. He wanted to see it all again, the endless blanket of red, the overarching blue sky where those great white cloud ships sailed, and the dark tower. He was afraid of the darkness which lived within that eldritch column, waiting to eat anyone who got too close, but he wanted to see it again just the same, needed to see it. The hand, however, would not stop shaking. The dream began to darken, and the smells of car exhaust along 2nd Avenue became the smell of wood smoke, thin now because the fire was almost out. It was Susanna. She looked scared. Eddie sat up and put an arm around her. They had camped on the far side of the alder grove, within earshot of the stream babbling through the bone-littered clearing. On the other side of the glowing embers which had been their campfire, Roland lay asleep. His sleep was not easy. He had cast aside his single blanket and lay with his knees drawn up almost to his chest. With his boots off, his feet looked white and narrow and defenseless. The great toe of the right foot was gone, victim of the lobster thing which had also snatched away part of his right hand. He was moaning some slurred phrase over and over again. After a few repetitions, Eddie realized it was the phrase he had spoken before keeling over in the clearing where Susanna had shot the bear.
"Go then. There are other worlds than these."
He would fall silent for a moment, then call out the boy's name.
"Jake! Where are you? Jake!"
The desolation and despair in his voice filled Eddie with horror. His arms stole around Susanna, and he pulled her tight against him. He could feel her shivering, although the night was warm. The gunslinger rolled over. Starlight fell into his open eyes.
"Jake, where are you?" he called to the night. "Come back!"
"Oh, Jesus, he's off again. What should we do, Suze?"
"I don't know. I just knew I couldn't listen to it any more by myself. He sounds so far away. So far away from everything."
"Go then," the gunslinger murmured, rolling back onto his side and drawing his knees up once more. "There are other worlds than these."
He was silent for a moment. Then his chest hitched, and he loosed the boy's name in a long, blood-curdling cry. In the woods behind them, some large bird flew away in a dry whir of wings toward some less exciting part of the world.
"Do you have any ideas?" Susanna asked. Her eyes were wide and wet with tears. "Maybe we should wake him up?" "I don't know."
Eddie saw the gunslinger's revolver, the one he wore on his left hip.
It had been placed in its holster on a neatly folded square of hide within easy reach of the place where Roland lay.
"I don't think I dare," he added at last. "It's driving him crazy."
Eddie nodded.
"What do we do about it? Eddie, what do we do?"
Eddie didn't know. An antibiotic had stopped the infection caused by the bite of the lobster thing. Now Roland was burning with infection again. But Eddie didn't think there was an antibiotic in the world that would cure what was wrong with him this time.
"I don't know. Lie down with me, Suze."
Eddie threw a hide over both of them, and after a while her trembling quieted.
"If he goes insane, he may hurt us," she said.
"Don't I know it?" This unpleasant idea had occurred to him in terms of the bear, its red, hate-filled eyes, and had there not been bewilderment as well, lurking deep in those red depths, and its deadly slashing claws. Eddie's eyes moved to the revolver, lying so close to the gunslinger's good left hand, and he remembered again how fast Roland had been when he'd seen the mechanical bat swooping down toward them, so fast his hand had seemed to disappear. If the gunslinger went mad, and if he and Susanna became the focus of that madness, they would have no chance. No chance at all. He pressed his face into the warm hollow of Susanna's neck and closed his eyes. Not long after, Roland ceased his babbling. Eddie raised his head and looked over. The gunslinger appeared to be sleeping naturally again. Eddie looked at Susanna and saw that she had also gone to sleep. He lay down beside her, gently kissed the swell of her breast, and closed his own eyes.
"Not you, buddy. You're going to be awake a long, long time."
But they had been on the move for 2 days, and Eddie was bone-tired. He drifted off, drifted down.
"Back to the dream," he thought as he went. "I want to go back to Second Avenue, back to Tom and Jerry's. That's what I want."
The dream did not return that night, however. 30. They ate a quick breakfast as the sun came up, repacked and redistributed the gear, and then returned to the wedge-shaped clearing. It didn't look quite so spooky in the clear light of morning, but all three of them were still at pains to keep well away from the metal box with its warning slashes of black and yellow. If Roland had any recollection of the bad dreams which had haunted him in the night, he gave no sign. He had gone about the morning chores as he always did, in thoughtful, stolid silence.
"How do you plan to keep to a straight-line course from here?" Susanna asked the gunslinger.
"If the legends are right, that should be no problem. Do you remember when you asked about magnetism?" She nodded. He rummaged deep into his purse and at last emerged with a small square of old supple leather. Threaded through it was a long silver needle.
"A compass," Eddie said. "You really are an Eagle Scout."
Roland shook his head. "Not a compass. I know what they are, of course, but these days I keep my directions by the sun and stars. And even now, they serve me quite well."
"Even now?"
Susanna asked, a trifle uneasily. He nodded. "The directions of the world are also in drift."
"Christ," Eddie said.
He tried to imagine a world where true north was slipping slyly off to the east or west, and gave up almost at once. It made him feel a little ill, the way looking down from the top of a high building had always made him feel a little ill. "This is just a needle, but it is steel, and it should serve our purpose as well as a compass. The beam is our course now, and the needle will show it." He rummaged in his purse again and came out with a poorly made pottery cup. A crack ran down one side. Roland had mended this artifact which he had found at the old campsite with pine gum. Now he went to the stream, dipped the cup into it, and brought it back to where Susanna sat in her wheelchair. He put the cup down carefully on the wheelchair's arm, and when the surface of the water inside was calm, he dropped the needle in. It sank to the bottom and rested there.
"Wow!" Eddie said. "Great! I'd fall at your feet in wonder, Roland, but I don't want to spoil the crease of my pants."
"I'm not finished. Hold the cup steady, Susanna."
She did, and Roland pushed her slowly across the clearing. When she was about 12 feet in front of the door, he turned the chair carefully so she was facing away from it.
"Eddie!" she cried. "Look at this!"
He bent over the pottery cup, marginally aware that water was already oozing through Roland's makeshift seal. The needle was rising slowly to the surface. It reached it and bobbed there as serenely as a cork would have done. Its direction lay in a straight line from the portal behind them and into the old, tangled forest ahead.
"Holy shit! A floating needle! Now I really have seen everything."
"Hold the cup, Susanna." She held it steady as Roland pushed the wheelchair further into the clearing, at right angles to the box. The needle lost its steady point, bobbed randomly for a moment, then sank to the bottom of the cup again. When Roland pulled the chair backward to its former spot, it rose once more and pointed the way. "If we had iron filings and a sheet of paper," the gunslinger said, "we could scatter the filings on the paper's surface and watch them draw together into a line which would point that same course."
"Will that happen even when we leave the portal?" Eddie asked.
Roland nodded. "Nor is that all. We can actually see the beam." Susanna looked over her shoulder. Her elbow bumped the cup a little as she did. The needle swung aimlessly as the water inside sloshed, and then settled firmly back in its original direction. "Not that way," Roland said. "Look down, both of you, Eddie at your feet, Susanna into your lap." They did as he asked. "When I tell you to look up, look straight ahead, in the direction the needle points. Don't look at any one thing. Let your eyes see whatever it will. Now, look up." They did. For a moment, Eddie saw nothing but the woods. He tried to make his eyes relax, and suddenly it was there, the way the shape of the slingshot had been there inside the knob of wood, and he knew why Roland had told them not to look at any one thing. The effect of the beam was everywhere along its course, but it was subtle. The needles of the pines and spruces pointed that way. The greenberry bushes grew slightly slanted, and the slant lay in the direction of the beam. Not all the trees the bear had pushed down to clear its sightlines had fallen along that camouflaged path, which ran southeast, if Eddie had his directions right, but most had, as if the force coming out of the box had pushed them that way as they tottered. The clearest evidence was in the way the shadows lay on the ground. With the sun coming up in the east, they all pointed west, of course. But as Eddie looked southeast, he saw a rough herringbone pattern that existed only along the line which the needle in the cup had pointed out.
"I might see something," Susanna said doubtfully. "But look at the shadows. The shadows, Suze."
Eddie saw her eyes widen as it all fell into place for her.
"My God! It's there! Right there! It's like when someone has a natural part in their hair."
Now that Eddie had seen it, he could not unsee it. A dim aisle driving through the untidy tangle which surrounded the clearing. A straight-edge course that was the way of the beam. He was suddenly aware of how huge the force flowing around him, and probably right through him, like X-rays, must be, and had to control an urge to step away, either to the right or left.
"Say, Roland, this won't make me sterile, will it?"
Roland shrugged, smiling faintly.
"It's like a riverbed," Susanna marveled. "A riverbed so overgrown you can barely see it, but it's still there. The pattern of shadows will never change as long as we stay inside the path of the beam, will it?"
"No," Roland said. "They'll change direction as the sun moves across the sky, of course, but we'll always be able to see the course of the beam. You must remember that it has been flowing along this same path for thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of years. Look up, you two, into the sky." They did, and saw that the thin cirrus clouds had also picked up that herringbone pattern along the course of the beam, and those clouds within the alley of its power were flowing faster than those to either side. They were being pushed southeast, being pushed in the direction of the dark tower. "You see, even the clouds must obey." A small flock of birds coursed toward them. As they reached the path of the beam, they were all deflected toward the southeast for a moment. Although Eddie clearly saw this happen, his eyes could hardly credit it. When the birds had crossed the narrow corridor of the beam's influence, they resumed their former course.
"Well," Eddie said, "I suppose we ought to get going. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step and all that shit."
"Wait a minute." Susanna was looking at Roland. "It isn't just 1,000 miles, is it?"
"Not anymore."
"How far are we talking about, Roland? 5,000 miles? 10?
"I can't say. It will be very far."
"Well, how in the hell are we ever going to get there with you two pushing me in this goddamn wheelchair? We'll be lucky to make 3 miles a day through yonder draws, and you know it."
"The way has been opened," Roland said patiently. "And that's enough for now. The time may come, Susanna Dean, when we travel faster than you would like."
"Oh, yeah?"
She looked at him truculently, and both men could see Detta Walker dancing a dangerous hornpipe in her eyes again.
"You got a race car lined up? If you do, it might be nice if we had a damn road to run it on."
"The land and the way we travel on it will change. It always does." Susanna flapped a hand at the gunslinger. "Go on with you," it said.
"You sound like my old mama saying God will provide."
"Hasn't he?" Roland asked gravely.
She looked at him for a moment in silent surprise, then threw her head back and laughed at the sky.
"Well, I guess that depends on how you look at it. All I can say is that if this is providing, Roland, I'd hate to see what had happened if he decided to let us go hungry."
"Come on, let's do it," Eddie said. "I want to get out of this place. I don't like it."
And that was true, but that wasn't all. He also felt a deep eagerness to set his feet upon that concealed path, that highway in hiding. Every step was a step closer to the field of roses and the tower which dominated it. He realized, not without some wonder, that he meant to see that tower or die trying.
"Congratulations, Roland," he thought. "You've done it. I'm one of the converted. Someone say hallelujah."
"There's one other thing before we go." Roland bent and untied the rawhide lace around his left thigh. Then he slowly began to unbuckle his gun belt.
"What's this jive?" Eddie asked.
Roland pulled the gun belt free and held it out to him. "You know why I'm doing this," he said calmly.
"Put it back on, man."
Eddie felt a terrible stew of conflicting emotions roiling inside him, could feel his fingers trembling even inside his clenched fists.
"What do you think you're doing?"
"Losing my mind, an inch at a time. Until the wound inside me closes, if it ever does. I am not fit to wear this, and you know it."
"Take it, Eddie," Susanna said quietly.
"If you hadn't been wearing this goddamn thing last night when that bat came at me, I'd be gone from the nose up this morning."
The gunslinger replied by continuing to hold his remaining gun out to Eddie. The posture of his body said he was prepared to stand that way all day if that was what it took.
"All right," Eddie cried. "God damn it, all right."
He snatched the gun belt from Roland's hand and buckled it about his own waist in a series of rough gestures. He should have been relieved, he supposed, hadn't he looked at this gun, lying so close to Roland's hand in the middle of the night, and thought about what might happen if Roland really did go over the high side? Hadn't he and Susanna both thought about it? But there was no relief, only fear and guilt, and a strange, aching sadness far too deep for tears. He looked so strange without his guns, so wrong.
"Okay, now that the numbfuck apprentices have the guns and the master's unarmed, can we please go? If something big comes out of the bush at us, Roland, you can always throw your knife at it."
"Oh, that," he murmured, "I almost forgot." He took the knife from his purse and held it out hilt first to Eddie.
"This is ridiculous," Eddie shouted.
"Life is ridiculous."
"Yeah, put it on a postcard and send it to the fucking Reader's Digest."
Eddie jammed the knife into his belt and then looked defiantly at Roland.
"Now can we go?"
"There is one more thing," Roland said.
"Weepin' creepin' Jesus."
The smile touched Roland's mouth again. "Just joking," he said. Eddie's mouth dropped open. Beside him, Susanna began to laugh again. The sound rose, as musical as bells in the morning stillness. It took them most of the morning to clear the zone of destruction with which the great bear had protected itself. But the going was a little easier along the path of the beam, and once they had put the deadfalls and tangles of underbrush behind them, deep forest took over again, and they were able to move at better speed. The brook which had emerged from the rock wall in the clearing ran busily along to their right. It had been joined by several smaller streamlets, and its sound was deeper now. There were more animals here. They heard them moving through the woods, going about their daily round, and twice they saw small groups of deer. One of them, a buck with a noble rack of antlers on its upraised and questioning head, looked to be at least 300 pounds. The brook bent away from their path as they began to climb again, and as the afternoon began to slant down toward evening, Eddie saw something.
"Could we stop here? Rest a minute?"
"What is it?" Susanna asked.
"Yes," Roland said, "we can stop."
Suddenly Eddie felt Henry's presence again, like a weight settling on his shoulders. "Oh, look at the sissy. Does the sissy see something in it, twee? Does the sissy want to carve something, does he? Oh, ain't that cute?"
"We don't have to stop. I mean, no big deal. I just
saw something," Roland finished for him. "Whatever it is, stop running your everlasting mouth and get it."
"It's really nothing."
Eddie felt warm blood mount into his face. He tried to look away from the ash tree which had caught his eye.
"But it is. It's something you need, and that's a long way from nothing. If you need it, Eddie, we need it. What we don't need is a man who can't let go of the useless baggage of his memories."
The warm blood turned hot. Eddie stood with his flaming face pointed at his moccasins for a moment longer, feeling as if Roland had looked directly into his confused heart with his faded blue bombardier's eyes.
"Eddie?" Susanna asked curiously. "What is it, dear?"
Her voice gave him the courage he needed. He walked to the slim, straight ash, pulling Roland's knife from his belt.
"Maybe nothing," he muttered, and then forced himself to add, "Maybe a lot. If I don't fuck it up, maybe quite a lot."
"The ash is a noble tree and full of power," Roland remarked from behind him, but Eddie barely heard. Henry's sneering, hectoring voice was gone. His shame was gone with it. He thought only of the one branch that had caught his eye. It thickened and bulged slightly as it ran into the trunk. It was this oddly shaped thickness that Eddie wanted. He thought the shape of the key was buried within it, the key he had seen briefly in the fire before the burning remains of the jawbone had changed again and the rose had appeared. Three inverted V's, the center V both deeper and wider than the other two, and the little S shape at the end. That was the secret. A breath of his dream recurred. "Dadachum, dadachee, not to worry, you've got the key." "Maybe," he thought. "But this time I'll have to get all of it. I think that this time 90% just won't do." Working with great care, he cut the branch from the tree and then trimmed the narrow end. He was left with a fat chunk of ash about 9 inches long. It felt heavy and vital in his hand, very much alive and willing enough to give up its secret shape. To a man skillful enough to tease it out, that was. Was he that man? And did it matter? Eddie Dean thought the answer to both questions was yes. The gunslinger's good left hand closed over Eddie's right hand.
"I think you know a secret."
"Maybe I do."
"Can you tell?"
He shook his head.
"Better not to, I think. Not yet."
Roland thought this over, then nodded.
"All right. I want to ask you one question, and then we'll drop the subject. Have you perhaps seen some way into the heart of my problem?"
Eddie thought, and that's as close as he'll ever come to showing the desperation that's eating him alive.
"I don't know. Right now I can't tell for sure, but I hope so, man. I really, really do."
Roland nodded again and released Eddie's hand.
I thank you. We still have 2 hours of good daylight. Why don't we make use of them?
Fine by me. They moved on. Roland pushed Susanna, and Eddie walked ahead of them, holding the chunk of wood with the key buried in it. It seemed to throb with its own warmth, secret and powerful.
32. That night, after supper was eaten, Eddie took the gunslinger's knife from his belt and began to carve. The knife was amazingly sharp and seemed never to lose its edge. Eddie worked slowly and carefully in the firelight, turning the chunk of ash this way and that in his hands, watching the curls of fine-grained wood rise ahead of his long, sure strokes. Susanna lay down, laced her hands behind her head, and looked up at the stars wheeling slowly across the black sky. At the edge of the campsite, Roland stood beyond the glow of the fire and listened as the voices of madness rose once more in his aching, confused mind. There was a boy. There was no boy. Was. Wasn't. Was. He closed his eyes, cupped his aching forehead in one cold hand, and wondered how long it would be until he simply snapped like an overwound bowstring. "Oh, Jake," he thought, "where are you? Where are you?" And above the three of them, Old Star and Old Mother rose into their appointed places and stared at each other across the starry ruins of their ancient broken marriage. 2. Key and Rose. 1. For 3 weeks, John Jake Chambers fought bravely against the madness rising inside him. During that time, he felt like the last man aboard a foundering ocean liner, working the bilge pumps for dear life, trying to keep the ship afloat until the storm ended, the skies cleared, and help could arrive. Help from somewhere. Help from anywhere. On May 31st, 1977, 4 days before school ended for the summer, he finally faced up to the fact that no help was going to come. It was time to give up, time to let the storm carry him away. The straw that broke the camel's back was his final essay in English comp. John Chambers, who was Jake to the three or four boys who were almost his friends, if his father had known this little factoid, he undoubtedly would have hit the roof, was finishing his first year at the Piper School. Although he was 11 and in the sixth grade, he was small for his age, and people meeting him for the first time often thought he was much younger. In fact, he had sometimes been mistaken for a girl until a year or so ago, when he had made such a fuss about having his hair cut short that his mother had finally relented and allowed it. With his father, of course, there had been no problem about the haircut. His father had just grinned his hard, stainless steel grin and said, "The kid wants to look like a Marine, Laurie. Good for him." To his father, he was never Jake and rarely John. To his father, he was usually just the kid. The Piper School, his father had explained to him the summer before, the bicentennial summer that had been, all bunting and flags and New York Harbor filled with tall ships, was, quite simply, the best damn school in the country for a boy your age. The fact that Jake had been accepted there had nothing to do with money, Elmer Chambers explained, almost insisted. He had been savagely proud of this fact, although even at 10, Jake had suspected it might not be a true fact, that it might really be a bunch of bullshit his father had turned into a fact so he could casually drop it into the conversation at lunch or over cocktails. "My kid, oh, he's going to Piper. Best damn school in the country for a boy his age. Money won't buy you into that school, you know. For Piper, it's brains or nothing." Jake was perfectly aware that in the fierce furnace of Elmer Chambers' mind, the gross carbon of wish and opinion was often blasted into the hard diamonds which he called facts, or, in more informal circumstances, factoids. His favorite phrase, spoken often and with reverence, was, "The fact is," and he used it every chance he got. The fact is, money doesn't get anyone into the Piper School, his father had told him during that bicentennial summer, the summer of blue skies and bunting and tall ships, a summer which seemed golden in Jake's memory, because he had not yet begun to lose his mind, and all he had to worry about was whether or not he could cut the mustard at the Piper School, which sounded like a nest for newly hatched geniuses. "The only thing that gets you into a place like Piper is what you've got up here." Elmer Chambers had reached over his desk and tapped the center of his son's forehead with a hard, nicotine-stained finger. "Get me, kid?" Jake had nodded. It wasn't necessary to talk to his father, because his father treated everyone, including his wife, the way he treated his underlings at the TV network where he was in charge of programming and an acknowledged master of the kill. All you had to do was listen, nod in the right places, and after a while he let you go. "Good," his father said, lighting one of the 80 Camel cigarettes he smoked each and every day. "We understand each other, then. You're going to have to work your buttski off, but you can cut it. They never would have sent us this if you couldn't." He picked up the letter of acceptance from the Piper School and rattled it. There was a kind of savage triumph in the gesture, as if the letter was an animal he had killed in the jungle, an animal he would now skin and eat. "So, work hard. Make your grades. Make your mother and me proud of you. If you end the year with an A average in your courses, there's a trip to Disney World in it for you. That's something to shoot for, right, kiddo?" Jake had made his grades, A's in everything, until the last 3 weeks, that was. He had, presumably, made his mother and father proud of him, although they were around so little that it was hard to tell. Usually there was nobody around when he came home from school except for Greta Shaw, the housekeeper, and so he ended up showing his A papers to her. After that, they migrated to a dark corner of his room. Sometimes Jake looked through them and wondered if they meant anything. He wanted them to, but he had serious doubts. Jake didn't think he would be going to Disney World this summer, A average or no A average. He thought the Nut House was a much better possibility. As he walked in through the double doors of the Piper School at 8:45 on the morning of May 31st, a terrible vision came to him. He saw his father in his office at 70 Rockefeller Plaza, leaning over his desk with a Camel jutting from the corner of his mouth, talking to one of his underlings as blue smoke wreathed his head. All of New York was spread out behind and below his father, its thump and hustle silenced by two layers of thermopane glass. "The fact is, money doesn't get anyone into Sunnyvale Sanitarium," his father was telling the underling in a tone of grim satisfaction. He reached out and tapped the underling's forehead. "The only thing that gets you into a place like that is when something big time goes wrong up here in the attic. That's what happened to the kid. But he's working his goddamn buttski off, makes the best fucking baskets in the place, they tell me. And when they let him out, if they ever do, there's a trip in it for him. A trip to the way station," Jake muttered, then touched his forehead with a hand that wanted to tremble. The voices were coming back, the yelling, conflicting voices which were driving him mad. "You're dead, Jake. You were run over by a car, and you're dead. Don't be stupid. Look, see that poster? Remember the Class 1 picnic, it says. Do you think they have class picnics in the afterlife?" "I don't know, but I know you were run over by a car." "No!" "Yes. It happened on May 9th at 8:25 a.m. You died less than a minute later." "No, no, no!" "John?" He looked around, badly startled. Mr. Bissett, his French teacher, was standing there looking a little concerned. Behind him, the rest of the student body was streaming into the common room for the morning assembly. There was very little skylarking and no yelling at all. Presumably, these other students, like Jake himself, had been told by their parents how lucky they were to be attending Piper, where money didn't matter, although tuition was $22,000 a year, only your brains. Presumably, many of them had been promised trips this summer if their grades were good enough. Presumably, the parents of the lucky trip winners would even go along in some cases. Presumably, "John, are you okay?" Mr. Bissett asked. "Sure," Jake said. "Fine. I overslept a little this morning. Not awake yet, I guess." Mr. Bissett's face relaxed, and he smiled. "Happens to the best of us." "Not to my dad. The master of the kill never oversleeps." "Are you ready for your French final?"
Mr. Bessette asked.
"Voulez-vous faire l'examen cet après-midi?"
"I think so," Jake said. In truth, he didn't know if he was ready for the exam or not. He couldn't even remember if he had studied for the French final or not. These days, nothing seemed to matter much except for the voices in his head.
"I want to tell you again how much I enjoyed having you this year, John. I wanted to tell your folks, too, but they missed Parents' Night."
"They're pretty busy," Jake said. Mr. Bessette nodded.
"Well, I have enjoyed you. I just wanted to say so, and that I'm looking forward to having you back for French, too, next year."
"Thanks," Jake said, and wondered what Mr. Bessette would say if he added, "but I don't think I'll be taking French, too, next year, unless I can get a correspondence course delivered to my postal box at good old Sunnyvale." Joanne Franks, the school secretary, appeared in the doorway of the common room with her small silver-plated bell in her hand. At the Piper School, all bells were rung by hand. Jake supposed that if you were a parent, that was one of its charms. Memories of the little red schoolhouse and all that. He hated it himself. The sound of that little bell seemed to go right through his head.
"I can't hold on much longer," he thought despairingly. "I'm sorry, but I'm losing it. I'm really, really losing it."
Mr. Bessette had caught sight of Ms. Franks. He turned away, then turned back again.
"Is everything all right, John? You've seemed preoccupied these last few weeks. Troubled. Is something on your mind?"
Jake was almost undone by the kindness in Mr. Bessette's voice. But then he imagined how Mr. Bessette would look if he said, "Yes, something is on my mind. One hell of a nasty little factoid. I died, you see, and I went into another world, and then I died again. You're going to say that stuff like that doesn't happen, and of course you're right. And part of my mind knows you're right, but most of my mind knows that you're wrong. It did happen. I did die." If he said something like that, Mr. Bessette would be on the phone to Elmer Chambers at once. And Jake thought that Sunnyvale Sanitarium would probably look like a rescuer after all the stuff his father would have to say on the subject of kids who started having crazy notions just before finals week. Kids who did things like that couldn't be discussed over lunch or cocktails. Kids who let down the side. Jake forced himself to smile at Mr. Bessette.
"I'm a little worried about exams, that's all."
Mr. Bessette winked. "You'll do fine." Ms. Franks began to ring the assembly bell. Each peal stabbed into Jake's ears and then seemed to flash across his brain like a small rocket.
"Come on," Mr. Bessette said. "We'll be late. Can't be late on the first day of finals week, can we?"
They went in past Ms. Franks and her clashing bell. Mr. Bessette headed toward the row of seats called Faculty Choir. There were lots of cute names like that at Piper School. The auditorium was the common room. Lunch hour was outs. Seventh and eighth graders were upper boys and girls, and of course the folding chairs over by the piano, which Ms. Franks would soon begin to pound as mercilessly as she rang her silver bell, was faculty choir. All part of the tradition, Jake supposed. If you were a parent who knew your kid had outs in the common room at noon, instead of just slopping up tuna surprise in the caf, you relaxed into the assurance that everything was A-okay in the education department. He slipped into a seat at the rear of the room and let the morning's announcements wash over him. The terror ran endlessly on in his mind, making him feel like a rat trapped on an exercise wheel. And when he tried to look ahead to some better, brighter time, he could see only darkness. The ship was his sanity, and it was sinking. Mr. Harley, the headmaster, approached the podium and imparted a brief exordium about the importance of finals week and how the grades they received would constitute another step upon the great road of life. He told them that the school was depending on them, he was depending on them, and their parents were depending on them. He did not tell them that the entire free world was depending on them, but he strongly implied that this might be so. He finished by telling them that bells would be suspended during finals week, the first and only piece of good news Jake had received that morning. Ms. Franks, who had assumed her seat at the piano, struck an invocatory chord. The student body, 70 boys and 50 girls, each turned out in a neat and sober way that bespoke their parents' taste and financial stability, rose as one and began to sing the school song. Jake mouthed the words and thought about the place where he had awakened after dying.
At first he had believed himself to be in hell, and when the man in the black hooded robe came along, he had been sure of it. Then, of course, the other man had come along, a man Jake had almost come to love. But he let me fall. He killed me. He could feel prickly sweat breaking out on the back of his neck and between his shoulder blades. So we hail the halls of Piper, hold its banner high. Hail to thee, our alma mater, Piper, do or die. God, what a shitty song, Jake thought. And it suddenly occurred to him that his father would love it.